Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
On the 12th of January 2020, pensioner Liam Farrell went to two pubs in his local village in Rooski, as was his usual routine on a Saturday night. And witnesses who saw him that evening recalled meeting the usual pleasant, kind Liam and remarked how he was in good form when he left to walk home. Well, he was later found by his daughter slumped at his own back door. He was covered in blood, his shoes and socks were removed, his watch was broken, and he had bruising to his left eye and his feet. A jury at Carrick and Shannon Coroner's Court delivered an open verdict into Liam's death last week, and his family have said they believe their father was attacked. Brendan Farrell, Liam's son, is on the line now, and I'm also joined by Frank Buttimer, solicitor for the Farrell family. And you're both welcome, and thank you for being with us. Brendan, first to you. Good morning to you, firstly.
Good morning, Claire. Thank you very much.
Will you tell me a little bit about your dad, about Liam? He was 87, but he was a big, strong man.
Oh, my God. He was a big, strong man. He worked for over 40 years at Hanley's Meat Factory, which is incidentally just up from the birthplace, just to give people an idea of Albert Rillins, the former Taoiseach in Rooski, in the village. Mm-hmm. And he worked there for over 40 years. He ran the local farm there with his wife, my late mum, Maureen. And he was a big, strong man. He was full of life. Everybody loved him. And he was just a gentle giant, you know.
And he was well known and, as I said, they're well liked around the place.
He was well liked. And do you know what? If you ask anybody in the locality about Dad, they'll have great stories and great memories of Dad. And he was a very positive man, Claire. You know, if there was a storm or bad weather coming in, I'd be saying, God, there's bad weather coming. And he'd put a positive spin on it. He'd say, it's not going to be as bad as they're saying. Mm-hmm. He'd always turn a negative into a positive. And I think it came on the back of growing up. He told me one time, growing up in the 30s and 40s, you know, times were tough. He came through the tough times, he got on with life and appreciated life. And after my mum died in 2002, he just grabbed life. He loved his family, his grandchildren. He loved us. And he loved Christmas. He loved everything about the family. And he would often head off to Knock and spend a few hours around Knock. He'd go to Mass every day in Borncoola, just a short journey away. So he was a busy man as well. He always had a project on. Mm-hmm. He was a very strong man. He was a very tall man, very strong man, but very positive energy and just loved people, you know.
And very active, Brendan. And, you know, it's remarkable that the night that he went out that Saturday, he walked down about 7 minutes walk, was it, to get down to Rooski?
That's correct, Claire. And in fact, he had done his daily routine walk up to the roundabout, which is about a mile and a bit earlier on that day. And he was in Muhull getting a bit of shopping and down in the village. He had the dinner down in Drummond, the local village, went in to see his elderly neighbours. Even though he was 87, he went in to see his elderly neighbours for the chat. And that evening, as he would normally done all his life, he went down that few short minutes down to have a few drinks. And that's what it was, Claire. He went down to have a few wee drinks. Normally, he would come home, he'd have tea, a sandwich, and he'd be up good and early the next morning, Sunday morning, for Mass in Borncoola. Then he'd get the newspapers. I'd be out in the afternoon, Sunday afternoon, my sister. And that was life. It was a simple life.
So tell me about what you know about what happened that night when he was out. He went to the two pubs in Rooski, didn't he?
Yeah, so I suppose the first pub he went to was Peter Rillins's, and he was there for a little while. And then when he left Rillins's, he went to the pub next door, which is the Weir Lodge pub. Mm-hmm. We estimate, due to records, etc., that he left the Weir Lodge pub in around 10 past 12:15. And as he would always do, he'd come out, walk across the road and walk up on the correct side of the road home. The last man was our local taxi driver who seen him. And he said, your father was in full flight. He was very well known for his stature and his big, strong walk. And the taxi man told me, he says, your dad looked brilliant. He was in great form and he flew by the car. Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing unusual, did you hear, about his visit to the pubs on that night?
Well, unfortunately, yes, there was. And this came out and it became very apparent in the inquest, Claire. In the first pub, we had two witnesses that spoke publicly at the inquest to say that Dad was sitting on his own, and then he was joined by a man, and they gave a description of this man, and they found it very unusual. They thought it was so unusual that one of the ladies followed my dad out to see was he okay. This particular lady then followed that particular man out when he left afterwards. So basically, in short, what happened there was my dad was having a drink. He was joined by a man, and this particular gentleman he was talking to was having a Coke. My dad left some time after. This man stayed on, finished his Coke. But to this woman, she said she was alerted, and so much so that she followed him out the door, and she followed my dad out. She noticed my dad was in the next pub. She did note on the day that when she followed that particular man out, that she couldn't find him. She doesn't know where he went. Okay. So that was a huge shock to hear that. I suppose my dad, if he was in a public house, if there was anything unruly going on, something that, you know, if it got a bit noisy, if things got out of hand a bit, he would remove himself from the situation, do you know?
Yes.
And nobody, I mean, Daddy wouldn't have had any problems. I mean, everybody spoke highly and loved him so much. So, you know, he had no enemies.
So tell me when you first found out that something terrible had happened.
So I was working with my driving school business, and I had to go in on that particular Sunday, which was the 12th of January, and I was working, and the next thing I seen a call coming in from my sister, pulled in, answered the call, and my God, she was in a horrific state. She said, Daddy's on the ground, he's cold, I think he may be attacked. I said, did you ring the ambulance? She said, no. I said, drop the phone, I'm ringing the ambulance and I'm on the way. What happened next was I rang the ambulance, and I told them to bring the guards as well. And I rang my wife to go to Daddy's house as well. So my wife arrived second on the scene, and then I was third on the scene. When my wife got there, the paramedics were on the speakerphone to my sister, and they said, go out to the front gate to direct the ambulance in. As she was going out, on the second time she was coming in and out, she noticed very large running type footprints in a diagonal direction at the front of my father's house, which mm-hmm. should not be the case. Also, there was other type footprints along the curb. So that really worried her. And, you know, she was looking around at this stage to see what else was going on, you know.
Yeah, and he was in a very bad state, wasn't he, when your sister found him and then when you arrived?
Claire, this was the most horrific day in my life. This is my home. This is where I grew up. When I came around the corner, I seen somebody on the ground. I didn't recognize that person as my dad. His injuries were horrific from head to toe. His eye was black. There was a lot of blood, a lot of injuries on his face, cut under his chin. There was a lot of injuries on his hands. There was a lot of injuries on his feet. The little toe was still bleeding. His shoes and socks were about a foot and a half to 2 foot out very neatly from his body. His body was pushed back into a 90-degree angle of a wall, so much so that when they went to give him mouth to mouth, they couldn't get his head tilted enough. His tie was still tied in a bow to his left hand side. There was a lot of blood on it. Incidentally, his collar was placed down. His watch was broke. That was to the right-hand side of his body. There was a mop bucket, a lot of blood, and a mop. There was wood with blood on it. It was carnage. It was horrific. As I was doing the compressions, I remember counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and I'm looking around and I'm thinking, who did this? There was coats placed in either side of him, his overcoat and his blazer, just to keep him warm, I imagine. And I think whoever was there probably panicked, didn't want this to turn out this way, or maybe thought it wouldn't turn out this way, but try to comfort them in some way. Mm-hmm. It was horrific. Oh, this was horrific thing.
It's an awful picture that you paint, you know, and I'm so sorry that you had to go through it and your sister. It's a dreadful, dreadful scene. The ambulance came. He was taken to Sligo Hospital at that point. So will you talk to us about what happened then?
So what happened was, as I was doing the compressions, I could hear the siren coming down the road and I couldn't believe it. You know, I could hear them coming. So they arrived in and they wanted to put Dad on the stretcher to get him into the ambulance to put the shocks on him because the ground was damp. And they worked and worked and worked. And they said to me, "You keep talking to your dad." In the middle of this, I did ask them to remove his false teeth. That was one thing that I was shocked about because the rest of his clothes was off, but his teeth were still in. So I knew then, you know, definitely there was something wrong. They worked and worked as much for as long, it seemed like hours. And they said, "Keep talking." And I kept telling Dad, "Look, they're here. They're working on you. You're going to be okay." And I try to warm him up as much as I could, rubbing his arms and the whole lot. And unfortunately then, you know, Dad was pronounced dead that evening and he was brought to Sligo Hospital where a post-mortem was carried out the next morning. And the problem about that is, and this came very evident in the inquest, that had the pathologist, Dr. Paul Hartel, and he said this through his own admission at the inquest, had he been told that Daddy's house, the scene was sealed off, he would not have carried out a post-mortem and he would have referred it to a forensic pathologist, i.e. a state pathologist. And we feel we've lost so much ground there.
Well, look, that's a good moment for me to bring in Frank Buttimer, who, as I said, is on the line as well. Because, Frank, that is a key part of what was heard during the inquest last week, isn't it? That, you know, there is a huge significance around a hospital pathologist being involved in a case like this, as opposed to a forensic pathologist. Will you explain that to us and what happened in this case?
Yeah, you're right about that, Claire. First of all, what happened in this case is that when the remains of the late Mr. Farrell were removed to the hospital in Sligo, for some reason that isn't clear and needs to be addressed, the histopathologist, Dr. Hartel, seems not to have been told that already at the time when he was being required to carry out the post-mortem, a crime scene had been declared back in the Farrell house, that the police were already pursuing an active investigation, that it was quite clear to the police back at that stage that it is likely that a crime had been committed involving the application of violence to the late Mr. Farrell, which may have caused or contributed to his death, leave aside the physical appearance of the late Mr. Farrell as presented. So if it had been communicated to him that this was potentially and in all likelihood at that time a crime, he would have deferred his examination to a suitably qualified forensic pathologist. Dr. Hartel's activity was solely at that point in time to determine the cause of death. It was not to carry out a forensic analysis on the remains of the late Mr. Farrell, such as might be relevant to a criminal trial or to a police inquiry. He conceded, and I think my own evidence from Professor Jack Crane, whom I retained on behalf of the family to give evidence at the inquest, he conceded that a benefit was lost in terms of the non-carrying out of a proper forensic analysis.
And Frank, just to explain to people, Professor Jack Crane is the former state pathologist for Northern Ireland. So you and the Farrell family asked him to review the autopsy. Now, what did he say at the inquest?
He said he had no doubt that Mr. Farrell was the subject of an assault, what he described as he was the victim of blunt force trauma. That was actually also agreed, by the way, by the second state pathologist who did a review of the late Mr. Farrell some months after the first assessment by the first doctor. Professor Crane went on to say that the blunt force trauma was not in and of itself the cause of Mr. Farrell's death, but he was satisfied to state to the coroner's inquest that the blunt force trauma was the precipitating factor in relation to the onset of the heart attack, which was actually ultimately determined to be the medical cause of death. Mm-hmm. Therefore, Professor Jack Crane identified a criminal act being perpetrated on the body of the late Mr. Farrell. Therefore, you know, that's where the family are in relation to their concerns.
Right, and we might talk about in a moment what all of this means. But Brendan, I'm sure that was difficult for you to hear last week from Jack Crane, but it has left you now being quite convinced that your dad was assaulted outside his home on that night.
From the moment, absolutely, 100%, Claire. And from the moment, you know, if we take away detectives, guards, ambulance crew, take away media, strip it down and take away everything, we're left with my sister, my wife and myself and daddy in this horrific state at the back door. And that's where I've been for the last 4 years, 8 months. And it's just absolutely horrific. It's as if it's after happening now. Every time you talk about it again, it's just as if it's live. I knew when I seen Dad, you know, if there was a blade of grass out of shape around that property, I would know it. But when I seen the scene at Dad's house, as I was working on him, I knew he was placed there. It was staged without any doubt. He wouldn't be able to do all that himself. And bear in mind, one of the other factors that came out in the inquest was the fact that I had asked paramedics about a bone that was sticking up. And reference was made to that it could be a broken collarbone. And that came up numerous times. There was just so many injuries. Just so many injuries. I'm lost for words because this was the most horrific thing. I wouldn't wish it on anybody to see it.
But you now have heard from Jack Crane, who has said that the injuries that he has saw from his review of the report were defensive type wounds.
Defensive type wounds, and the words there that Professor Crane has used is blunt force trauma. That he suffered blunt force trauma and defensive wounds on his hands. And there I am thinking, poor daddy's trying to protect himself with his two hands.
And Frank, where does this go now? I know you've been corresponding with the Director of Public Prosecutions. Where does this all lead to?
The DPP, it had indicated through correspondence initially with the family and subsequently with myself that there was not sufficient evidence in the opinion of the DPP, the Director of Prosecution. The family, and rightly so, as you can understand, Claire, would have very limited information from an Garda Síochána, owing to the need to maintain the integrity and, you know, the discretion that they would require in relation to criminal investigations. But so the family have been given general reasons as to why a prosecution has not up to now been directed. However, they don't, by the way, know against whom a prosecution might have been considered, and that's fair enough too. However, at this point in time, the family's request is, or requirement is, that there will be a renewed commitment by An Garda Síochána to pursue inquiries. One of the disadvantages that all families have in circumstances of this kind is not knowing what the police know. I do say fair enough, but here, at the moment, the family's position, as communicated by An Garda Síochána and the DPP, is that in the absence of further evidence, in the absence of further information, the file remains open, but more information is required. The family are saying publicly that they want people to come forward and give whatever information they have.
So, Brendan, for you, and we'll end with you on this, you and your family, what is it that you want now?
Right now, I would, put this forward, and hopefully he's listening to the Commissioner, Mr. Drew Harris. I would ask him to intervene and open up a brand new investigation into our father's death. I believe there is a lot more people to be talked to. There's a lot more to be found out. And again, we put out that appeal to the public to please, if you have any information, no matter how big or how small, to please come forward with it to the Garda confidential number.
And you've sought a meeting, I know, with the Minister for Justice, haven't you, Helen McEntee?
I have, yes, and we're hoping to meet with the Minister for Justice. This is only the start of it, as far as I'm concerned. Due to the outcome now of the inquest, it's even copper fastened what we already knew, that our father was attacked. And we need to do everything in our power to move this forward and get a new investigation.
All right. Well, Brendan, thank you for talking to us. And Frank Buttermer too. Frank Buttermer, solicitor for the Farrell family. And Brendan there, who you heard, is Liam Farrell's son.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.